We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon to you both.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Another stellar week in the Empire.
I thought you were going to say another busy week.
I thought you were going to say
another word that begins with S.
Well, no. Many apply. All right, so last week, starting out with local news, last week, Job, you had talked a bit about Jeff Nelson, and there's been some updates on that.
Yeah, he was arraigned on Monday, charged with murder. This is the former Auburn police officer who is charged with the 2019 death of Jesse Seri. And it took 16 months for those charges to be filed. And it was it's the first time that under the initiative that was passed in 2018 that a police officer in the state of Washington has been charged with crime committed while on duty. That's actually the first time that's happened in generations. Because the previous law made it virtually impossible for prosecutors to charge police officers. You had to prove personal animus toward the victim, which, of course, is almost never the case. This was the case we talked about last week where Seri was had mental health problems. He was the police were called because he was in a grocery store, and the concern was disturbing the peace. And somehow, in 67 seconds, that escalated to his being fatally shot by Nelson. And this was the third time that Nelson had actually used deadly force in his 11 years on the Auburn Police Department force. So this was a police officer who probably should have that strike two should have been enough. The previous cases were also in questionable circumstances. And the arraignment was seen as an enormous victory, not just the Seri family, but families of a number of police victims in King County over the past several years were present for it. Charlene Lyle's family members, of a number of other shootings, Renee Davis, the Muckleshoot, tribal member who was shot in 2016. Her family members were there, and a number of others as well. So this was really kind of a breakthrough. So Nelson now is in King County Jail on $500,000 bond, and it will probably be several months before he is actually tried. But we'll keep an eye on that. Because it really is a breakthrough moment in terms of police accountability in Washington State.
Yeah, it's the first test of I-940, I believe, was the initiative number that was passed in 2018 to reform the state's laws in regards to charging and prosecuting police officers who have committed murder or used excessive force that's way out of line.
Yeah, and as we said last week, the particular circumstances of this killing were, they're so egregious that, they were able to charge him.
We talked about that last week, but essentially Nelson, he beat Jesse Seri with his fists, and shot him in the stomach. And when Seri fell, Nelson cleared a round that had jammed out of his gun. And then as Seri was on the ground, Nelson turned around and shot him in the head, execution style. So it really was a terrible, terrible, terrible use of force. And, you know, obviously it's murder, right? So this is something that we've been waiting for a long time, is to see this kind of a case brought to the courts and to see an officer really held accountable for that.
Yeah, and Nelson pled not guilty, and he will almost certainly claim self-defense. But, you know, he's already on the ground and shot in the chest, and the second shot – really, there's no self-defense argument there. At least there shouldn't be. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens when that before a jury.
And Sari's crime, he jaywalked. That was his crime.
Yep.
So, yeah. So there's no excuse, really. I also want to talk about a couple of different tort claims that were filed this past week. The father.
Oh, I should mention also there's a civil case from Sari's family for $10 million against the city of Auburn. So there's that too.
There's that too. And then there were a couple of tort claims that were filed this week. The father of Lorenzo Anderson, who was the 19-year-old that was shot inside the CHOP, filed three tort claims of $1 billion each against the city of Seattle, King County, and the state of Washington over his son's death. On the morning of June 20th, Anderson was approached by a man named Marcel Long inside the CHOP, a man with whom he'd fought before. Anderson and Long argued, and Long pulled a gun, chasing Anderson before shooting him at least four times. Folks inside the CHOP called 911 at about 2:20 a.m. On the morning of June 20th. Fire department personnel staged outside of the CHOP and refused to enter without a police escort. But police showed up at the opposite end of the zone and waited at least 15 minutes before attempting to enter the CHOP. By that time, the desperate medics inside CHOP that had been treating Anderson had already transported him to Harborview in a private vehicle because they couldn't wait any longer for the fire department to arrive. Horace Anderson is now trying to obtain information about what led to the SPD abandoning the East Precinct building and who made the decision to not provide safety and medical assistance to residents within the CHOP zone and the surrounding area, including his son, on the morning that he was shot. A tort claim.
He was shot, as I recall, short a little bit outside the actual CHOP.
Yeah, actually, Marcel Long chased him for a ways, and he was actually outside the CHOP zone when he was shot. So there really was no excuse for the fire department to go to a different street and wait outside the zone while there was all this confusion back and forth on the police band radios trying to figure out where, you know, the cops went to the opposite end of the zone and there was miscommunications and then the cops just sat there and, you know, I guess probably took a smoke break or something, I don't know, while they decided that they were going to enter CHOP to try to find someone who was shot outside the zone. So, you know, it was a lot of confusion. And I think Anderson has a good case in trying to determine what happened to his son on that morning. And I want to say, too, a tort claim is filed in preparation for a lawsuit. It's not an actual lawsuit yet. It gives the government agencies notice that the plaintiff is seeking evidence and some kind of explanation and damages for what happened. And if they do find misconduct or encounter resistance from these government agencies, then a lawsuit usually follows. So that's the first tort claim I want to talk about. The second is the relatives of Manuel Ellis have filed a tort claim against the Tacoma Police Department for $30 million. Manuel Ellis died on March 3rd when Tacoma Police Department officers and at least one Pierce County Sheriff's officer restrained him in handcuffs. Video footage from a home security camera show that Ellis was protesting that he couldn't breathe while they restrained him. Before he passed away, the Pierce County Medical Examiner then determined that Ellis's death was a homicide. The Pierce County Sheriff's Department was investigating the death, but when the news came out that at least one of their deputies was involved in the scene and possibly also one of the deputies that was restraining Ellis during that incident, Governor Inslee stepped in and he moved the investigation out of the hands of the Pierce County Sheriff's Department and into the hands of the Washington State Patrol and the State Attorney General's office. Eyewitnesses have come forward to say that Ellis wasn't doing anything to provoke the police. It was actually the cops who attacked Ellis. The tort claim doesn't name those officers, but a future lawsuit might name them. It was officers Christopher Burbank, Matthew Collins, Masia Ford, and Timothy Rankin. So,
and we should also mention yesterday would have been Ellis's, I believe, 27th birthday.
Yeah, and that's why they filed the claim yesterday.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Nope. Right.
Let's move on to...
We're not done with police news, though.
No, we are. No. We are just getting started. Starting out with Wednesday evening.
Yeah, Wednesday evening was a mess. Of course, the daily marches have been happening in the morning and the evening, and they've generally been peaceful. They may inconvenience their particular targets, and on the evening of Wednesday evening, the evening march, which has been going to the homes or the offices in this case of the various public officials or people associated with police accountability. On Wednesday evening, they went to the Seattle Post of the State Patrol, which is down on the very north end of Capitol Hill at Roanoke and Harvard. And
kind of the Mott Lake area.
No, it's actually up the hill.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit west.
It's considered North Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
It's sort of between Montlake and Eastlake. For whatever reason, the evening march leaders had worked out an arrangement with the state patrol people that were there. But the SPD chose to attack them that evening. I was watching the live stream at the time, and it really was unprovoked. And they particularly targeted prominent live streamers who've been live streaming. That's how I was watching it.
I just want to say that that just about every week the evening march does a candlelight vigil for Summer Taylor, who was killed on I-5 by a driver who drove around barriers onto I-5 when it was closed off for a protest.
They did that on this evening because they were targeting the state patrol who had failed to block the entrances and allowed that driver on I-5.
Right. But it was a candlelight vigil, so they were all sitting around talking. It was very, very peaceful, extremely calm until the SPD exhibited some of the behavior and the problematic acts that the OPA, the Office of Police Accountability, the Office of Inspector General, and the Community Police Commission had condemned in their reports last week, including the, you know, forming a riot line against a peaceful vigil, and the indiscriminate use of pepper spray on a crowd, you know, shoving a stationary crowd into motion and forcing it to stampede, assaulting the media. You know, like you said, Jav, breaking car windows and breaking people's cell phones, using crowd control devices in a residential neighborhood, and escalating.
And they also broke at least one of the cameras of the live streamers.
Yeah. Just escalating violence against protesters who were doing nothing more than just sitting around quietly talking. It was outrageous.
And if the concern was that they were, you know, massed near the entrance of a freeway, there's literally a park across the street, and they could have been moved into that park without that kind of use of force. So it really did seem retaliatory by the police department. These were officers out of the East Precinct. And it's exactly the kind of abuse of police power that people were protesting in the first place. So, you know, this is supposed to discourage people from protesting? No, it makes people angry and makes people come back and protest again, which they did. Now, we should mention also that on Monday night, two nights previous, they had been protesting at the East Precinct. There was at least one attempt to set East Precinct building, or at least the area adjacent to the East Building, East Precinct, on fire. And this had to be seen as retaliatory for that, because there's absolutely nothing that was happening on that evening that could have justified that kind of use of force.
Yeah. And then later that week, a video came out on social media and on the website of the Seattle Emerald of the Seattle Police Department Sergeant Michael Teachin speeding through an intersection in an SPD van on the night of August 13th and driving up onto a sidewalk attempting to hit protesters who are gathered on the sidewalk. In the video, you can see him sitting inside his idling van while a bystander says to him, "I saw you hit almost a bunch of people." And Teachin says that, yes, that was him, and talks about how the protesters ran like cockroaches. Then he goes on to say that Seattle is dirty and gross, and that, quote, "they pay me like 200 grand a year to babysit those knuckleheads every night because they smash up all the businesses," end quote. The bystander then says, "don't you think you could have hurt somebody? Seriously, hurt somebody?" And Teachin replies, "no, I'm a professional." In other words, in his opinion, breaking a few windows is a crime worth the death penalty. And he's judge, jury, and executioner, and a well-paid one, too. And that about sums up the culture at the Seattle Police Department right now.
Yeah, you really have to come to the conclusion that the police department is out of control, either because Beth never had control of it in the first place, or because now that she's a lame duck, she has resigned, but the resignation is not effective until, I believe, next month.
September 1st, which is Monday.
Yeah, that officers feel like it's a free game to do whatever they want. And you can see that, this pattern of behavior with SPD has been going on, for a long time, certainly all of Jenny Durkin's mayorship. And, she's not holding anybody to account either. It's really very, very dysfunctional at SPD. And I hope that these incidents this week will make their attention to the federally appointed court monitor who's overseeing the reform process and who has to sign off on, a new police contract next year, if there is one. And,
yeah.
The city had been trying to declare that the police department was all reformed, and they've withdrawn that over the fact that Robart likely would have rejected it. So we'll see where that goes, because clearly SPD has the culture there is still very, very toxic. And we'll see what happens with a search for a new police chief, for example, and with the federal reform process. Because I can't help but imagine that the CPC and some of these other oversight boards that had those very critical reports last week, they're gonna petition the judge for action on this, I'm sure.
Yeah. Now, speaking of the police chief, the Seattle Times reported this week that nearly 2 weeks before her retirement announcement, Police Chief Carmen Best had asked the Washington Department of Retirement Systems to give her an estimate of what her retirement pay would be, and she gave them a retirement date of September 1st. And that's just, as I should mention, one day before the proposed pay cuts would take effect. Now, an SPD officer's pension is based on an average of their pay over their highest 60 consecutive months on the job, so a pay cut could have dropped her pension considerably. So Best was lying when she said it wasn't all about the money. It was absolutely all about the money, her pay in particular.
Now, yeah, and her retirement pay.
Yeah, Best asked for that estimate on July 28th. But didn't announce her retirement until the day after the city council approved the pay cut as part of the revised 2020 budget on August 10th, 2 weeks later. I should mention, too, that July 28th was several days before protesters actually showed up in her Snohomish neighborhood trying to get a chance to talk to her and were chased away by her white neighbors with their guns. So that, of course, even though she played that up for sympathy, that was never the reason for her retirement. It was all about the pay cut and all about her future pension.
And what is the police chief doing not living in Seattle? I mean,
Exactly. And I think it's pretty disingenuous for her to say, oh no, I'm retiring in protest because the city council is being mean to my officers in the Seattle Police Department, when in fact she was retiring in order to preserve her pension.
Hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Now, also this week I don't praise the Seattle Times very often, but this time I want to. There was an investigative report in the Seattle Times this week entitled "Fired But Still a Cop: How Washington State's Decertification Process Leaves Troubled Officers with Their Guns." And the author is Mike Reicher. It details the problems with Washington State's decertification process and shows why an officer can be fired from one police department in the state for misconduct or excessive use of force and still be able to get a job at another police department in the state where they can then go on and often do go on to reoffend. About 40 officers per year are fired on the grounds that are serious enough that their supervisors check the box on their paperwork that the officer should be decertified. But just 13 of those officers per year on average actually lose their state certification. That leaves another 27 each year who slip through the cracks and go on to work at other police departments and go on to reoffend. Washington State, the article points out, has never, ever decertified a single police officer over the charge of excessive use of force. Okay. They've been decertified for things like perjury, dishonesty, drug use or drug possession, or in one case, demanding sex from a driver during a traffic stop to avoid a ticket, but never ever for excessive use of force. So that article is definitely worth a read and you know, we all need to ask the state legislature to pass legislation that better funds the state department that handles the certification and decertification of the police so that they can hire at least one legal expert to combat the appeals that are filed by officers who then go on to not ever be decertified but can gain reemployment at a new police department where they go on to reoffend.
Yeah, sounds like it might be worth targeting another initiative on that too.
Yeah, so strengthening the ability for the state to decertify officers for excessive use of force and actually funding that department quite a bit better than it's being funded now so that it can hire the necessary personnel to pursue these cases.
And then before we move on to national, I'm sure you both saw footage I think it went up yesterday, of the new wall that they are building around the East Precinct, literally blocking the sidewalk, it appears to me, which is unusual, since that blocking the sidewalk is a primary motivator for the navigation team moving homeless people all over the city.
Well, the East Precinct building was not built as a precinct building. It was built and for many years served as a car dealership. So it has these big windows. It's not terribly secure and doesn't contain the security features that other buildings that are built as police precincts do. So this is kind of coming after the fact now. You know, they're gonna cover those enormous windows that precinct building has, and now they're putting up a concrete barrier too.
And it's a really central location on Capitol Hill. I mean, this is an area that has a lot of pedestrian traffic, so they are definitely blocking that off. And you know, I also wonder about that because I was hearing reports, particularly when the police department had abandoned that building, that they were happy not to move back in, and they would love to give that building to a community group because it has all kinds of remediation issues. They have a firing range in the basement, some other areas that really need some serious environmental remediation before they can unload the building to anything. So it's not really a very usable building for the city, but they're investing a lot of taxpayer money in trying to keep protesters away from it at this point.
Trying to shore it up, making it look like it's the green zone in Iraq or something. Of course, a lot of, you know, they do say that a lot of folks who are hired as police officers are former military veterans. So maybe some of them feel more at home now that they're behind a concrete wall.
Yeah, that keeps the people that they're supposed to be protecting and serving away from them.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to national and the situation in Kenosha.
Yeah, it's been a bad week in Kenosha, Wisconsin. On Sunday, just after our last show, we had the shooting of Jacob Blake, who has a history of domestic violence, and that was the call that police came out for. Now, according to family members, he was trying to separate two other people who were arguing. But police came after him, and he attempted to get back in his vehicle, which had three small children, ages 8, 5, and 3, in the vehicle.
I was not aware that Blake himself had a history of domestic violence. My understanding was that he was trying to separate two other women, and someone called the police on a domestic violence dispute. That
yeah,
Jacob
it didn't, it,
Jacob
it
Blake
didn't.
Himself. Is he used to work as a, you know, before he was shot, as a security guard. So it's kind of well within his skill set to kind of get between two people who are having a fight.
Right. And the problem was that he was charged with rape actually when he was in the hospital. And it came out later in the week that the DV history was in Lake County, Illinois, which is the next county south over the state border. So that's why it didn't come out immediately. But the thing is, and those charges have now been dropped, ludicrously, until yesterday, even though the shooting left him paralyzed from the waist down, he had been handcuffed to the hospital bed. And his lawyer would say, "Why are you handcuffing him? He can't go anywhere." It was really ludicrous, and
he's partially paralyzed now.
Yeah, he's apparently permanently paralyzed, and you know, the handcuffing came off like, you know, just petty revenge by the local police department, because his having been shot led to so much grief. There were three nights of genuine riots with a lot of buildings being burned. And on the third night, on Wednesday night, you had a local militia that mobilized to try and protect some of those businesses, and that brought out a 17-year-old from neighboring Lake County, Illinois, same county that Jacob Blake had once lived in, and he shot three protesters. Two of them died. Literally walked down the street with his long gun that apparently belonged to his parents. Had his hands up as if to surrender as they approached police officers, and then just let them walk past, even though they were responding to the shooting. So it took until the next day for him to be arrested in Illinois, where he is awaiting extradition now. And this raised all sorts of disturbing issues around vigilante violence. Significantly, probably, you had the vigilante couple from Illinois St. Louis, who had been highlighted in the Republican National Convention literally that afternoon, after they had waved guns at BLM protesters and become sort of folk heroes on the right for having done that. Of course, Kyle Rittenhouse, who is the 17-year-old who has now been charged with two counts of murder, along with some other charges, he is being lionized on social media in the right wing. for having taken out protesters. And it's really a disturbing snapshot into the political moment and how dangerous it is and how dangerous it likely will be when Donald Trump refuses to leave office after November. It's really a very, very disturbing situation.
Okay, so what I wanted to say about that too is that Jacob Blake was in that neighborhood on that day to drop off presents for a friend's 8-year-old son. Okay, now police officers who came to the scene of a domestic violence call, a fight between two women, of course, didn't focus on the women who were part of the actual call. They immediately saw a black man and they focused on him as the threat. Okay. Blake, and at that point, they didn't know who he was or if he had any charges against him. Officers say that Blake had a knife in his car. And I want to point out that I actually carry a pocket knife in my purse. So when you hear charges that a person had a knife in their pocket, or they had a knife in their car, or they had a knife somewhere around them or in their possession, you have to take those with a grain of salt.
Yeah, okay? it's common.
Yeah, it's very, very common.
Yeah. So a lot of people have knives or carry knives or have pocket knives. Okay.
And when somebody says a knife, that can mean a lot of different things. You know, similar to SPD's calling votive candles an explosive device. You know, that stuff gets exaggerated very easily. And if you've seen the video of Blake's shooting, the kids were in the car. They were watching this and they were right there. And police officers are supposed to be trained to react differently if there are children anywhere near a potential line of fire. That should never have happened. They attempted to prevent him from getting in the car. And unless you can see through the car door, they could not have possibly seen whether there was a knife in the car. But they pulled on his shirt to try and keep him from getting in the car. When he kept trying to get in the car, they shot him.
Seven times in the back.
Yeah, and that's why his spinal cord was severed, and the man is now paralyzed for the rest of his life. He's
from
very lucky to be alive.
Yeah, he's
very lucky to be alive.
Yeah, and now that night, the same police department, it completely ignored Kyle Rittenhouse after he had shot three people, killed two of them, and walked towards police in their vehicles with a gun slung across his body and his hands in the air.
Yeah, that wasn't the same night. That was Wednesday night.
Wednesday night.
That's exactly what happened. Yeah. And there's plenty of video of it. And it was shared, I watched it live streaming at the time.
There's a video, and there's also a video of the police giving kind words to Kyle Rittenhouse and the other members of his vigilante crew that he was with, and giving them, you know, bottles of water and saying, you know, we're so glad you guys are out here, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, kind of encouraging these right wing vigilante groups to patrol the streets with lethal weapons, not non-lethal weapons like the police have been using.
And you had the
I want to point out too that Rittenhouse was not a resident of Kenosha. He had driven across state lines from Illinois into Wisconsin. He was underage, and it was not legal for him to have that gun on the streets of that city that night. And
I read his mom drove him.
I don't know that for sure, but it's possible that she did. So, you know, I mean, it's incredible. And you know, you look at pictures of him, he doesn't look like he's an adult necessarily. So it's crazy that the police were, you know, out there saying, hey, it's so nice you guys are here. You want some water? Instead of asking him, hey, how old are you? What are you doing with that gun? You know, this is a dangerous situation. You people need to go home. All right. And then arresting him when they don't.
And you know that if it had been a black kid walking down the street with his hands up and a long gun, They would have paid attention.
They would have shot him. Yeah.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the Trump campaign gave a statement because, you know, on his social media, Kyle Rittenhouse's social media, you can see he was a gun lover. He was a huge supporter of the police, and he was a big fan of Donald Trump. Now, the Trump campaign gave a statement this week saying that Rittenhouse had, quote, nothing to do with our campaign, end quote. Although I would have to say that the Trump campaign probably had everything to do with what Rittenhouse decided to do on that night. Yeah. Because he was a fan and a follower of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has been talking a lot about how, you know, the police need to use excessive force against demonstrators to get them off the street. And if they don't do that, he's going to send in the National Guard, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's all kind of a wink and a nod to his right wing supporters to take their guns to the street and do what the police in their communities are not doing.
And as I said earlier, that you can see the result of the shooting on right wing social media, where Rittenhouse is now being celebrated as a hero.
Yeah, and organizations raising money for him for his legal defense.
Yeah. And should he not be in prison, he will never have to buy a beer for the rest of his life, once he's of age. So,
yeah, and I just want to, you know,
he'll have the very best lawyers.
Name the names of his victims, Anthony Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum. They did not deserve to be shot and killed by this kid.
No.
Now, on Friday, tens of thousands of people. I want to mention, too, that this happened in the same week. You know, there was a lot of media devoted to this. On Friday, tens of thousands of people packed the streets of Washington, D.C. and the National Mall for the Get Your Knees Off My Neck march to protest police brutality, voter suppression, and right-wing vigilanteism, and to call for legislative action.
It was also
got any press.
It was also the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington, and that drew 1963. Yeah, so yeah. It drew tens of thousands of people to the National Mall and Lincoln Memorial, and there was a lot of national media there, but it didn't get a whole lot of attention, which is a surprise. And I should also give a shout out because there was a march in the evening, and late last night there was a vigil for Summer Taylor in Washington, D.C. by the national activists who had come for that march. So that was very nice to see as well. But I wanted to talk about the Republican National Convention, which I think was sort of a snapshot of the vigilante justice that we saw in Kenosha this week. And very, very disturbing. It was, as you might expect, totally dedicated to the adulation of Donald Trump. It was highly fact-free, and it was dominated by the Trump family. And this is the sort of thing that you see in dictatorships, where it becomes a cult of personality around the leader and around the leader's family and the immediate people around the leader. And it traffics heavily in propaganda and heavily in trying to convince people that what they've seen with their own eyes is not happening. I saw a number of posts this week from people who are, you know, sort of experts in authoritarian regimes saying this is exactly what it looks like. This is happening now. And it really underscores, you know, on almost no matter what you think of Joe Biden, it is going to be a very, very dangerous time if he is not elected president. Because I don't think we'll have any elections in the future. That is the path that we saw with the Republican National Convention this week. And you notice that most of the politicians that you traditionally see at Republican conventions who have been leaders of the party in the past, Bushes, Romneys, et cetera, were conspicuously absent from the speaking roster. Instead, it was Bush family members and hagiographies. And, of course, Bush's speech himself before 1,500 people, not socially distanced, not wearing masks in the South Lawn, which is a violation of federal law of the Hatch Act. But, you know, who's going to enforce that? Because William Barr is attorney general. It was just a very, very disturbing spectacle all the way around.
All right. Anything else on the convention?
No, other than, you've been warned. They warned you that this is exactly the vision of America that they have.
We did see a couple of members of Congress questioning the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff this week, Mike Milley, asking him if he would obey the constitutionally elected president come November in case Donald Trump decides that he wants to mobilize the military to retain power.
Yeah, and Milley said that the military would not get involved.
Which is actually kind of key if you think about the fact that a lot of people may have to turn out on the streets to protest if President Trump decides to stay in power, and the military says, well, we're not gonna enforce Donald Trump's announcement. If they just hold back, that could be really key in allowing the American people to turn Donald Trump out of the White House.
Yeah, although, I think the question was actually asked in the context of, would you force Donald Trump out of the White House if he refused to leave? And they wouldn't get involved in that either. So it's not entirely clear
resolve. Actually, I think the question was asked, would you mobilize to keep him in office? I think actually was how the question was put to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's good. We're going to have an interesting next few months.
It'll
for
be
sure.
Interesting.
It will be.
And we mean that as a euphemism, I might add.
Yeah.
We can't really use most of the words that would most quickly come to mind to describe it.
No, but if that did slip out, luckily, not necessarily luckily, but I believe the FCC is, like the other agencies, has been so gutted that we should take time to...
This is true.
Yeah. All right.
And somebody would have to complain, and I doubt anybody would, but, yeah. But we'll defer anyway.
We'll keep it clean.
Yeah.
Let's move on, talking about Hurricane Laura and the devastation.
Yeah. This is a theme of the last couple of weeks that even as we deal with a virus, even as we deal with a crisis in democracy in our country and, the uprising around police accountability and everything else that's been going on this year, climate change is still with us and still an emergency thing. Hurricane Laura was one of two tropical depressions in the Gulf of Mexico this past week. The other one fell apart, but Laura did not. It intensified. The Gulf of Mexico waters are extremely warm right now. They're between 88 and 90 degrees in their area where Laura intensified at the last moment. It went from being a tropical depression in 24 hours to being a Category 4 and nearly a Category 5 hurricane with sustained winds of 150 miles an hour and gusts of 186, which is just unthinkable. And it was striking, unlike other major hurricanes of that size in the last 10 or 20 years, this hit in a populated area of the Gulf Coast around Lake Charles, Louisiana. And fortunately, it was a relatively fast-moving hurricane, so they didn't get the storm surges that they were predicting of up to 30 feet of water up to 40 miles inland, because that's a very low-lying area where it came ashore. So it really was – it could have been a worst-case scenario if the storm hadn't been moving quite as quickly as it did.
It was still pretty bad, though.
It was still very bad.
High winds pretty much tore Lake Charles and other populated areas around that where it came ashore, just completely tore them apart.
Yeah, and I actually worked at a radio station in Lake Charles once. I know that area really well. It has a lot of chemical plants, a lot of petrochemical plants. One of the chemical plants that's visible from downtown Lake Charles, although it's not in the city proper, caught fire and had plumes of toxic smoke the morning after the hurricane went through. So it really was a serious environmental issue as well. Lake Charles is going to take a long time to recover from that hurricane. They had had a direct hit in 2004 with Hurricane Rita, but this was much, much worse. And Rita was considered an extremely bad hurricane. So this was a very significant hurricane. We haven't heard a lot yet about the federal relief effort. Again, there's so much going on in the news right now that the national news after the hurricane hit really hasn't spent much time in Lake Charles. But that community, about 80,000 people, about 150 in the metro area, is just been decimated. And again, that kind of rapid intensification is something that we're seeing more and more with climate change. It is not something that was very common before the last, 10 or 15 years. But for instance, Hurricane Michael a couple of years ago on the Florida Panhandle did the same kind of thing, where it went from being, a relatively minor tropical depression to a major hurricane almost overnight. This one was predicted a little bit better, but that kind of intensification often means that communities aren't as prepared and people don't have the kind of time to evacuate that was necessary. There were something like 1.5 million people that wound up under mandatory evacuation orders with Laura, and there's just not the transportation infrastructure to move that many people that quickly.
Yeah, and a lot of those people may not have had any place to go, If you don't have relatives out of state, or you don't have the money to stay in a hotel, I mean, it can be really hard to evacuate wherever you are.
Yeah, right now there's a lot of poor Lake Charles residents, and I should mention also that petrochemical fire was in a poor black part of Lake Charles. So those folks
had to close their windows and doors. Extremely hot down there this time of year. Close their windows and doors, turn off their air conditioning units, which suck in air from the outside, and it's just been, really to try to keep the toxic fumes outside of their residences. It's just not been manageable for them.
Yeah, and a lot of those folks were bused to San Antonio, and they're now in shelters there, which is some 300 miles away. Because they didn't, they have to get that far away because they don't necessarily know what path the hurricane is going to take. And it was originally predicted to go a little bit further west than it actually did. So those folks are likely going to be living in shelters for months. And their homes may or may not be there when they get back. It's a very scary situation.
Yeah.
All right. Maria, what exactly happened to Trump's executive order about extended additional unemployment benefits?
Yeah, so if people remember, Congress recessed for the summer without passing an extension of the COVID-19 relief funds for unemployed people, mainly because the Republicans in the Senate didn't want to spend the money. So Trump signed an executive order to provide additional payments of about $300 to $400 to unemployed people, and to defer payroll taxes for employed people. But there were a couple of problems with his executive order. First off, the president doesn't have the power to reallocate money in the federal budget like that. Congress holds the power of the purse, not the president, and that's actually in the Constitution.
Although we should mention that Trump did exactly that when he took money out of the military budget and reallocated it on border wall construction.
That was illegal too. Trump told the states that they would be on the book for the additional unemployment payments, but I should point out that Congress states have been complaining to Congress that they don't have the money to fund their own budgets, much less additional unemployment.
Yeah. The problem with it was that the law under which he did it requires a 25% match from the states. So he originally announced it as $400. It turned out to be $300, and then the states have to provide the additional $100. And California came
back immediately.
But now he's
telling the states states that they should pay 100% of it, which they just don't have the money to do. And he said, well, the Congress will reimburse you for the 75%. But, as president, he really doesn't speak for Congress, obviously. So, of course, most states have not been able to implement it. And the third problem is that the Trump administration can't figure out how the payroll tax cut piece of it is supposed to work. Okay.
I'm sorry. Now, I shouldn't laugh.
You shouldn't laugh, but this is really typical of the Trump administration. There are all these people running around who don't know what their jobs are and don't know how to do their jobs and don't agree on how to do it.
They
don't agree on what the president actually said or did. Now, the idea is that workers
the president is so illiterate when it comes to actually knowing what he signed. Who knows whether he read it or whether he just signed a piece of paper that some staff person put in front of him and then read whatever communication shop told him to say. So it really isn't policymaking at all.
Yeah. So now the idea behind the executive order is that workers are supposed to get a tax holiday and that they won't have to pay Social Security and Medicare taxes for a number of months. But those taxes are not forgiven. They're deferred, which means that workers will then turn around and have to pay those taxes later. But although no one is quite sure when that later will be or whether it's going to be paid back all in one lump sum or whether we'll have to pay it back over a longer period of time, we just know that it means that employed people will eventually have a big tax bill to pay if they're not, you know, withholding now. Now, Larry Kudlow, the head of Trump's National Economic Council, wants businesses to cover that payment instead of workers. Steven Mnuchin, however, heads the Treasury Department, which controls the Internal Revenue Service and interprets federal law regarding taxes. And the Treasury Department usually issues rules on how new tax legislation is supposed to work in practice. Mnuchin thinks that the payroll tax deferral should be optional for businesses to implement if they want, and he's definitely of the school that says employees have to pay that tax. But we should point out
that Mnuchin is one of several billionaires in Trump's cabinet.
Yeah, but weeks have passed since Trump signed that executive order, and the deadline to implement the payroll tax deferral is approaching. That's Monday, September 1st. Tuesday, September 1st, and Treasury still hasn't released any rules about how the new payroll tax deferral will work. So businesses are literally still saying, hey, this deadline's coming up. We got payroll to figure what's going on, you know, and the Trump administration can't answer their questions. And of course, this may be because many big businesses and their lobbyists have been protesting to the Trump administration that they don't want to cover the tax for their employees and they don't want to burden their employees with having to pay back a huge tax bill later on. And if Larry Kudlow and Donald Trump get their way, these businesses could end up filing a lawsuit to stop the executive order altogether, which I think may turn out to be highly likely. In addition, there's the question of whether it makes sense to cut money that flows into the Social Security and Medicare funds at a time when Congress really needs to come up with a new way to increase revenue for these safety net programs, not cut them. So that's what's going on. And I would have to say, if you've been expecting a payroll tax cut to actually happen, you can keep waiting, but I don't think it's going to. It was really meant to be a nice photo op for Trump during a reelection year, but not something that can actually happen practically.
Ah, it's government by photo op.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
It's just pretty emblematic of the dysfunction and incompetence within the Trump administration.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's our best hope, I think, for avoiding a dictatorship is these people are really not competent. I wanted to talk
about Belarus. Talk about Belarus.
Yeah.
Belarus.
And, the dictator there, Lukashenko, who's been in power for 26 years, had an election I believe it was July 9th. And, it was widely considered a fraudulent election, of course, which he won by quite a bit. The original candidate that he was facing, is still in jail. That man's wife wound up being the candidate who stood in his place. And, she's been forced to go into hiding in another Baltic country because she feared for her life. There were enormous demonstrations this past month in Belarus. They got some attention in U.S. media, which is saying something for anything that happens overseas. And, you know, people were watching this in particular because Lukashenko is a patron of Vladimir Putin. Putin, in fact, has offered to send Russian troops to help defend Lukashenko's rule in Belarus, and because the protests are very specifically trying to depose him, and a lot of the people that are protesting are have been disappeared or are in jail. Certainly, the protest leaders, phones have been shut down, social media has been shut down, and this is really a template for ways that Donald Trump could try and stay in power illegitimately as well. It's very concerning because Lukashenko now looks like he has the upper hand and will be able to stay in power. The protests have continued in Belarus over the last week. They are notably smaller. And the people who are protesting are at notably greater personal risk by doing it, which is why they're smaller. So it's a very disturbing example of, you know, people power can work in deposing dictatorships, but it doesn't always work. And when it doesn't, the people who protest are at enormous risk. So bear that in mind. I, you know, there's ways in which it was not analogous at all with the United States. But, you know, you think of all those phone calls this year between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, and we don't know what the content of those phone calls are. It's kept a secret. But chances are very good that we know that Trump wasn't raising any issues that are pertinent to the U.S., like, oh, say, bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. More than likely, he's been taking instructions.
Yeah, which may be why we've been hearing stories from protesters in Kenosha that unmarked vehicles with agents that aren't wearing undercover agents that aren't wearing badges or identifying which agency that they're working from are scooping protesters off the street, holding them in jail for days at a time without allowing them phone calls or charging them with any crime.
Yeah, so, the group Riot Kitchen, which is basically a Food Not Bombs for the protesters, was in Kenosha, and their people were setting up for an afternoon protest, and were scooped up in an unmarked vehicle like that, and nobody knew for 2 days what had happened to them.
Yeah, they've all been released now, but there are other demonstrators too that have been scooped up, held for days at a time without any outside contact, and released without charges eventually. So never charged, but improperly imprisoned.
Very, very, essentially. Very similar to what happened in Portland when federal forces were there.
Yeah, and when these unmarked vans come up, I mean, it's a very scary situation because you don't know, are these right-wing vigilantes? Are these guys going to haul me off and murder me and leave my body in a ditch? The kind of thing that happens in other countries, but could start happening here in the United States.
Yeah.
Events.
Yeah, well, there are marches for police accountability that, as we mentioned, are going on morning and evening, and they gather in different locations each day. You can find out where they're gathering. The Morning March Seattle is a Facebook page for the Morning March. They usually gather about 7 o'clock and start marching about 8 o'clock. The Seattle Evening March is an Instagram account, and you can see there where they're going each evening. And the Evening March has been targeting elected officials and various other, you know, either office buildings or homes of people associated with the police accountability.
There's also an event on Sunday too, for the Native American woodcarver John T. Williams' 10-year anniversary of his death. He was shot by a Seattle police officer, Ian Burke, in 2010 for walking down the street carving a piece of wood with his headphones in his ears and a carving knife in his hand. So another instance in which a person of color had a knife in his hand and was just shot in the back by a police officer. So that
police officer wound up going and working for a different police agency, which is something we were talking about earlier, too.
Exactly. And so that memorial is going to be from 1 to 4 p.m. on Sunday at the Space Needle on Lower Queen Anne. So if you want to show up and show your support for Black and Brown Lives Matter.
Yeah.
And they encourage you to bring a mask and
yes.
socially distance.
Yep.
All right. Well, I'd like to say it's been fun.
It's been a kind of a grim week, actually.
It has.
Yep, it has.
And we look forward to talking with you both next week.
Here's hoping things are a little bit brighter next week.
Yeah. Sadly, I'm not optimistic about that.
Nor am I. All right. We'll talk to you both next week.
Thanks.
Yes.